We're going to talk today about memory. So, I'd like to read to you a psalm about memory. It's Psalm 137. If you have a Bible, you may turn there. If you don't have a physical Bible with pages, you may not look it up on your phone. There are too many distractions. You will get Facebook messages and tweets. Like, for example, I just got a tweet. For those of you who are thinking about St. Constantine College, I just got a notification that John Mark Reynolds just retweeted a tweet. He just retweeted a tweet by President Obama. So you process that and see what you want to do with it. So, Psalm 137, but only physical Bibles. All right, fine. If you need another one, use it. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. For there those who carried us away captive asked of us a song, and those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its very foundation. O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock. Of course, when I was a child, that last verse was my favorite. And then when I was later in my teen years, it makes a skeptic of everybody. I'm not going to say any more about that last verse. But I do want to reflect on how intense his desire to remember is. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. During this talk, you may hear the voices of ghosts. It is, after all, about memory. But my first reflection on memory is the intensity of our desire as human beings to be remembered. We want to be remembered. A few years ago, I think it was 2010, I got the news from a dear childhood friend that her mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so I wrote a letter to her, and I expressed my gratitude to her for the time she had given me when I was a child, the affection she had shown to me. I told her that I was praying for her, and she wrote back to me a very generous letter, a very grateful and gracious letter. What I remember from that letter is the PS, very simple, very direct. She said, thank you for remembering me. When somebody has Alzheimer's, I think there might even be more of a sensitivity to that. Nevertheless, we all want to be remembered. A little before that, I lived in Boise, Idaho. And in 2001, my family moved from Boise to Charlotte, North Carolina. And at the time, the families that I had been teaching had a picnic, a going-away picnic for me. And they gave me the opportunity, not knowing what they were doing, to give a farewell address of sorts. And in the course of that talk, I mentioned Odysseus, I mentioned Hamlet, I mentioned Aeneas, I mentioned a number of characters that we had read about in the course of the 4 years that we had been together, 5 years. And I said, like them, I have one request as I go away, which is, remember me. And it's 16 years ago Last week, I got a call from a friend in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, saying, my flight just got canceled. I need to get to Dallas. Can I stop at your place? And I said, of course. I would like nothing more than to see you. His name was Ty Rollins. He was one of the kids that I got to teach for 4 years. He remembered me, and I remembered him. And we got to spend the evening together. I was batching it. My wife was off with my mother-in-law at the time, but between my mother-in-law and my daughter, who was having a baby, who was born yesterday. Thank you. My first granddaughter. You'll all get to meet her eventually. But he called me because he knew he would be welcome. He called me because he remembered me, and I remembered him. And this is what our joy is. When I see last fall, I saw one of those students for the first time in about 8 or 9 years, and I didn't know that she was going to be there. I was at the Alcuin retreat in Richmond, Virginia, and I saw this student for the first time in 8 or 9 years, and I hadn't seen her since, 8 or 9 years before, and I didn't know she was going to be there. And I, you know that line, my heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky? That's nothing compared to the feeling when you see a former student, somebody that you love from old days, somebody that you haven't seen in a long time, who remembers you and that you remember. Our memories, my favorite sports commentator likes to write, memories make us rich. He doesn't even care if it's good or bad memories. He just says, memories make us rich. I think about that when I think of the philosophers. You know, we get into all these discussions about going to college and being able to pay off our school loans and being able to get a good job and everything. Well, the goal of a classical education is to not need a good job. It's to equip you for any job because you don't need any. That's kind of transcendent, don't you think? A while before both of those stories, there was a king of England. It's about 1215 AD, and he had decided he needed to attack France, and he knew that this was a great historical event, so he hired Shakespeare to write a speech. And that speech goes like this. It's not literally about today. It actually is in October. Okay, but he says, the king, this day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named. And at the name of Crispian.
He that shall see this day and live all day will yearly on the vigil feast his name. Say tomorrow is St. Crispian. Then he will strip his sleeve and show the scar and say, these wounds I had on Crispian's day, old men forget. It all shall be forgotten, but he'll remember with advantage is what feats he did that day. Then shall all our days, familiar in his mouth, his household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we then shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
Thanks, Josh. How did you know I was going to read that?
Just lucky.
Just lucky, wow. Well, we haven't yet reached the very ending of the world, but so far, good King Hal was right. They have been remembered. The good man does teach his son, well, until the 60s in England. The good man did teach his son, and Kenneth Branagh still makes good movies. And The Hollow Crown, I forget who played Henry V in The Hollow Crown, but they've made yet another good version of this speech. And every time this speech is repeated, Henry is remembered. And the few, the happy few, the band of brothers with him. And the echo of that memory Think about this. Can you imagine if you could give a speech that they would still be reciting in the year 2850? Wouldn't that be nice to be remembered that long? To be remembered is to be honored. To be remembered is to matter even after you are gone. To be forgotten is not to matter. To be thought unworthy the effort required to bring you to mind. There is a place for the forgotten. It's called oblivion. We want to be remembered. We also want to remember. You remember when Hamlet, the elder, the ghost, appeared to Hamlet the younger after he revealed to his son that his son's uncle, his own brother, had assassinated him and then married his wife? The ghost Hamlet ended his speech with this amplification. He said, "Fare thee well at once. Adieu, adieu, adieu. Remember me." And then he left. What was Hamlet's response? Something like this. "Oh, all you host of heaven. Oh, earth. What else? Shall I couple hell? Oh, fie. Hold my heart.
And you, my sinews, grow not instant old, but bear me stiffly up. Remember thee. Ah, thou poor ghost, while memory holds a seat in this distracted globe. Remember thee. Yea, from the tables of my memory, I'll wipe away all trivial, fond records. All forms, all saws of books, all precious past, that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed by baser matters, yes. Yes, by heaven. O most pernicious woman. O villain. Villain, smiling, damned villain. My tables, hate it is, I set it down, that one may smile, and be a villain. At least it seems so to me to be so in Denmark. So, uncle, there you are. Now to my word, it is adieu, adieu, remember me, I have sworn it.
Thank you. He did that from memory. Listening to the two talks that Shakespeare wrote for these kings, three thoughts have come to my mind. One is that it really pays who writes your speech for you. Second of all, Shakespeare has a very, very developed theory of memory. A very developed practice of memory. And it's got to do with speeches on the battlefield. It's got to do with the inner emotional element of memory. Has to do with the spiritual side of memory. And it has to do with the academic. Because what's so interesting and fascinating about that speech is every single word of it. But what strikes me right now is how Hamlet the elder is addressing Hamlet the younger like he's a student in school. And Hamlet the younger is playing on the whole late medieval, early Renaissance dynamic between writing and memory. So in Plato's Phaedrus, there's that scene that Wes mentioned yesterday about how Socrates thinks writing is bad, or at least the god of Egypt, Thoth, who has a bad lisp, thinks that writing is bad because if you write things down, you won't remember them as well. And you're mixing recollection with memory. Which, of course, is ironic because Plato writes down what he says about not writing things down. But, you know, one of the things that we've done, I hear this a lot in the last 200 or 300 years, or 500 years or so, we think that memory has been destroyed or is undercut because of writing, because of the technology, the Gutenberg press, for example. But do you know when they first came out with the Gutenberg press and when they were writing in the Middle Ages, the book was never regarded as a substitute for memory. It was always regarded as an aid to memory. You can go all the way back to Quintilian in the first century, and he gives tips like, when you read a book, always read the same one. Okay, and the reason you should do that is because then, you know this, if you're a book lover, you know this, that you remember things by where they are on the page. Reading is a very practical thing. And if people who read developed iPhones, they wouldn't put books on them. They're great for audio. And they're great for travel. But if you want to remember what you're reading, they're horrible because things are moving around all over the place. Well, what does Hamlet do? He says, remember thee, whilst memory holds a seat in this distracted globe. Remember thee, yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, which is the correct pronunciation. All saws of books, all forms, all pressures past. In other words, everything I've been taught up till this point, I'm going to erase it. I'm going to scrape it off. And he's using the metaphor of books, of the child writing in wax or writing on chalkboard or whatever they did in Shakespeare's day. And he's saying, I'm scraping it all off to remember one thing. Thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain. Isn't that a great picture? The book and volume of my brain. Thy commandment all alone shall, did you catch the verb? Live. Well, how can it live in the book and volume of his brain? Only if he remembers it. If he has to look it up, it's not alive. But if he writes it, he can repeat it, and he can repeat it until it comes to life. He can revive it. Do you see? And that's what he resolves to do. All saws of books, in other words, these are proverbs and maxims. Every proverb I had to learn at school, every blue, every good quotation I ever memorized, I'm never going to think about it. I'm scraping it out of my mind. All forms, maybe it's a poetic diction. Maybe he's referring to the sonnet. Maybe he's referring to Spenser's sonnets, which were super popular in that day. Maybe he's referring to poetic forms. I'm not sure. But he's cutting, and maybe he's meaning the whole thing that's there, right? If there's a form, there's actually a poem too. And he's going to just eliminate it from his mind. All pressures past. I think what he means there is things that he carved into the wax tablet. That youth and observation copied there. Copied. I've been copying these things. I've been supposed to think about them. I've been supposed to remember them. But I'm going to scrape them all off. I'll wipe away them all. He calls them trivial, fond records or records. Record is a really interesting word, isn't it? Where does the word record come from? You know, if you're old enough or cool enough now that they've caught up to the 60s, you can get these vinyl discs, right? Remember those? Right? And you can put them on this turntable, and it's called a record. The verb is to record. What does that mean? Well, it comes from the Latin word for cord, core, cordis, heart. To record is to inscribe something in your heart. And you do it by re-ing it, right? Now, re in Latin can mean again and again, like we think of it in English. It can also be an intensifier. But it seems to be that when we record something, initially the idea was, one way or another, we're getting it into our hearts so that we can what? Remember it. Remember is also a weird word to me because don't you have to dismember something before you can remember it? It turns out that's just a coincidence. It comes from the French. There's this Latin to French to English thing going on there. But it does have to do with reassembling. We recollect, right? You recollect something. And it's fascinating to me that all of these different words are being played on, imagine this, played on by Shakespeare, in a very, you could memorize, you could meditate on this speech by Hamlet, and you would learn an awful lot about how the memory works just by thinking about this speech. Same with the Henry V speech. More ceremonial, different kind of memory, but you would learn so much about how memory works just by memorizing those speeches and meditating on what Shakespeare's getting at, and then maybe doing some research about how school was done in his day back when memory mattered. You know why memory mattered in Shakespeare's day and it doesn't today? Because they believed in human beings back then. He says at the end of his talk, he repeats what his father had said. He says, now to my word, which can mean one of two things as I understand it. It can mean now to the promise I just made, or it can mean now to my motto, to my sort of think Middle Ages when they have the, what's that called? The image that they have on their shield. Crest, that would work. Let's use crest, okay. Their toothpaste, okay. So their crest or their motto, whatever it is, that thing I can't remember. He is saying, this is what's going to direct me from now on. This is going to be the thing I live by from now on. And those both work, my promise or this motto. And then, and what he says, that adieu, remember me. That's his word. Okay, remember me. That's what I'm going to think about. That is what is going to drive me. That is what is going to control all of my conduct from now on. Remember me. I have sworn. The oath he swears, in other words, is to remember his father. One might suggest that this oath is the foundation of civilized society, which is deeply at risk in Hamlet's day. What's happened, just to be very brief about this, what's happened in Hamlet's day is that the king has been overthrown, killed, assassinated, and this is bad for stable order. The new king was the king's brother and married the king's wife. This is really bad. Hamlet is supposed to be the king. When you're the son of the king and the king dies, you are the king. So by custom, by moral law, by natural law, whatever approach you want to take, the just and right king is Hamlet. But every single person in the court is being fed by the false king, which means that Hamlet is threatened by every single person in this world that he's living in. It's very much like a child at school. Perfect paranoia. How do I know how to relate to all these different people? And this might be part of the reason why he falls back on one simple thing that he now always needs to do. Remember me. Remember your father. And his task as king, the rightful king, the fundamental, the first task of a king is to ensure the succession. And the whole play is about Hamlet making sure that he fulfills his duty as king. And he succeeds, by the way. The Hamlet is actually a comedy. You might not have noticed that. What you need to notice, too, is that in order to fulfill his word, before he can write his word, he has to scrape off other things. In other words, to remember, he has to forget. To attend to one thing, he has to ignore other things. He has to focus. This is important in memory. Because I mentioned earlier the word record. The world has wandered a very long distance from recording, meaning putting something into your heart, to recording, meaning putting something on a vinyl disc. From the beginning of technology, we have feared the reduction of the heart to external wax, and we have feared thoughts not penetrating to within, but I think in our age, we've just decided that thoughts are external anyway, so what difference does it make? Thoughts are about information. You can always look it up. Let me repeat what I said earlier. If you have to look it up, it's dead. Until it is living in your mind, until it is memorized or close to memorized or conceptually understood, it will not change you. it will not do its duty or its wish, which is what truth is always trying to do. Do you understand this? That what the truth is always trying to do is to heal your soul? Yes, you become powerful when you gain knowledge, of course. But that's not why you gain knowledge. You gain knowledge to be healed by it. And if we leave it constantly outside, then we are becoming people who love power but have disordered souls. And that's bad when powerful people have vicious souls. So Hamlet wants to write it down and delete everything else so that he can keep coming back to it and internalizing it. He wants to drive it into his heart through review, the way we teachers fantasize our students want to do when we say something. Imagine if you could teach as well as Hamlet. All you got to do is be a ghost. He wants to be sure that he remembers, and his father wants to be sure that he is remembered. And he ought to be remembered. So if we want to be remembered and we want to remember, it is also true that we ought to remember certain things. There are some things that should be remembered. You might remember the words of Galadriel from Tolkien that they put at the beginning of the movie. She said, and
that should not have been forgotten or lost. History became legend. Legend became myth. And for 2,500 years, the ring passed out of all knowledge.
Some things that should not have been forgotten were lost. Does this say anything about our age? Hamlet chose to resolve to forget some things. But some things get lost that shouldn't have been forgotten. And what our culture and age has been making clearer and clearer is what matters to you is what you try to remember. Think of the unforgettable Penelope. Penelope in the Odyssey was remembered by the very gods. Why? Well, Homer tells us. There's a wonderful phrasing in a translation that I've only found this quotation, and I haven't actually read the quotation, but there's a wonderful phrasing where the author describes what Penelope has done as being loyally mindful. She was loyally mindful of her husband. In Lattimore's translation, which I like a lot, it goes like this. Surely Odysseus won himself a wife endowed. Thank you. Now, my conviction is that that song for prudent Penelope is the Odyssey, and that this actually is being recited in Hades by Agamemnon, who's in Hades because his wife killed him. It's a bad ending. Penelope, on the other hand, remembered Odysseus well. She was loyally mindful of Odysseus. This is the very first conference in 17 years where my wife has not attended it. I'm forgiving her because she's with our daughter. But the one thing it brings to mind, just thinking about the fact that she's not with me, is how for many years now, I've been traveling all over the country, sometimes even across the border. I've been gone way too much. Well, how do you measure that? I've been called to travel. And never once have I doubted or feared that when I came home, she was going to kill me. Now, there have been times when I've been at home where I thought she might kill me. Never once in 17 years have I feared that she would be unfaithful to me. In fact, I'm going to just say something. Some of you may have heard me tell this story, and it's a dumb, stupid thing I did when I was about 25 years old. I was in a college class, and I was a part-time student, the only person who was older than 18 or 19 years old, and probably one or two people were in the class were married. I had been married by then for 5 years. And the class was called Love and Its Myths. And in the course of the discussion, the topic of knowing that the other person will be faithful to you came up. And every single person in the class insisted that you cannot know. And I said, because I was old and wise and very experienced, I said, I absolutely know for certain that my wife will never be unfaithful to me. You would not believe how angry they got. And I look back on that now, and experience and time has vindicated me. But I didn't need time and experience to tell me that that would be the case. I knew her soul. I knew the kind of person she was. I knew the kind of memories she held on to. I knew who she was. And I grant you, I got extremely lucky in the person I married. I married Penelope. Look at those words on the screen. How good was proved the heart that is in blameless Penelope. Who doesn't want that said about them in the end? And why? Why was she blameless? Why was her heart proved good? Because of how well she remembered Odysseus. Now, most women in our culture see that as oppressive. And let me just go ahead and say that's why they can't be happy. How well she remembered Odysseus, her wedded husband. And look at what happens because of her virtue, because of her memory. Well, because of her virtue that is rooted in her memory. Thereby, the fame of her virtue shall never die away. Why? Because the immortals, the gods, will make for the people of earth a song for prudent Penelope. The gods will ensure that the people will always have Penelope to look to. I'm sorry for the popping, but Penelope has too many P's. And then you had prudent and people. What's wrong with this guy? The immortals will make for the people of earth a song for prudent Penelope. What does that mean? She will be remembered. That's what it means. It means she ought to be remembered. You think Odysseus didn't remember? Everywhere he went, he was like a modern college student having everything you could possibly want, only it was on a goddess's island. And as she said to Odysseus when he said he wanted to go home, you know, I'm always going to be this hot. And your wife is going to get old. And he said, I want to go home. I don't want to be a god. I want to be a man. She She will be remembered because she was virtuous. She was remembered because she was virtuous, and she was virtuous because she remembered. And there are things that we also must remember if we hope to be virtuous and faithful people. Our choices about what we remember, what we inscribe in the book and volume of our mind, please hear that word, they are choices. We decide what we choose to recall. We decide what we strive to recall. And I would propose to you that these choices that we do make ought to be guided not by what feels good and what gets us a better grade, but they ought to be decided by and guided by what our duties are. In other words, what really makes us happy. I know that duty is such a nasty word in our culture, but look, duty is, as Robert E. Lee said, the noblest word in the English language, because it is by fulfilling our duties that we become who we can become, that we can become virtuous. And we cannot be happy. We're like dogs this way, right? The one thing a dog wants to know is, what can I do to please you, master? A dog cannot be happy if the master doesn't make it clear. We know what our master wants us to do. Often. And when we don't, we feel disoriented. We need to rejoice in our duties. We need to hunger for and thirst for righteousness and for justice, which is the fulfillment of our duties. We need to stop thinking it's a bad thing to do your duty, which is another way of saying it's your duty to not do your duty. We are human beings. And as human beings, we have duties as humans to remember what a human being is. That child that you love so much, do you know why you love that child so much? No, you don't. Don't pretend. We have no idea why. We can say, because that's our child. Well, that's kind of, you know, redundant, right? Circular reasoning. That child is the image of God. And so are you. And when we forget that, we cannot possibly, deliberately, ever do that child any good. We can accidentally, because of somebody else's wisdom, do good things for the child. But if we forget that that child is the image of God, and we do not, and I mean by forget, not act on, if we do not remember in our hands and in our words and in our thoughts and in our feet that that child is the image of God, we will harm that child. If we forget that that child is the temple of the living God and that the living God himself intends to walk in his courtyard and meet him in the sanctuary of his heart, then we cannot possibly do that child good. If we forget that that child is the image of a three-personed God and is therefore himself a person, which if nothing else means he's a mystery, not one that we can control and regulate and understand. If we forget that he is a person and an image in a temple, then we will reduce him to less than he is and we will be incapable of blessing that child deliberately. By God's mercy, we can bless, as I said, because other people give us ideas in spite of us. We must remember. We must remember what that child is. We need to remember what a human being is made for. And this, I think, we're guilty of. A human being is made for eternal fellowship with the living God. A human being is made to hear from our Lord Jesus himself in the presence of the angels and in the presence of all the witnesses and saints of all ages, to hear from our Lord himself, well done, good and faithful servant. And if you are preparing your child for anything other than that, you are condemning your child, or at least undercutting what he could possibly receive and achieve. He is made for eternal glory. What is the glory that you are seeking for your child and your students in your school and in your home? Is it earthly? Is it security? Or do you believe that if you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, then the Lord can look after the petty details, the things the Gentiles worry about? Do you understand that the reason our culture is in a meltdown is because we've given in to what the Gentiles are worried about? Another thing we have to remember is what humans have done. There's a book by an author called Elie Wiesel called The Kingdom of Memory. Elie Wiesel was in a concentration camp as a child and spent the rest of his life trying to bear witness to the experience so that we would remember. What's the words we used to always hear attached to any movie about or any description of the Holocaust? Lest we forget. We have to remember what human beings do. But the problem is we have to remember what the Nazis did to the Jews and what the communists did to the Christians and what people have done to each other. We live in a rape culture where 1 in 5 girls apparently is sexually abused in some way by the time they hit 30. We have to remember that people do these things not so that we can say those people are bad, but so that we can realize what our hearts are like. Because if you don't think America could have a Holocaust, you're deluded about human nature. We have to remember what human beings have done. It was human beings that enslaved hundreds of thousands and then millions of Africans in our country. It was human beings that have systematically destroyed culture after culture. It was human beings who accomplished the massacre in Rwanda. It's human beings that perform 1,000 selfish, nitpicky, ungrateful things every minute. And that's just me. It is human beings that crucified the Lord of glory. And if I'm lucky here, I can show you that it's also human beings who created YouTube. And Palestrina. Music now. I like it. Okay. It's human beings who are singing. Do you hear that? Those are humans. They aren't angels. It's a human who composed this music. It's human beings who built the Hagia Sophia. That building for 1,000 years was the biggest building on earth. There's the interior. If you want to see a good action flick that goes inside the Hagia Sophia, James Bond has one. Get some of the dimensions. That was a human being that designed that. There's a human being. Serafina and her mother, Larissa. The picture on the right is my favorite because it was the first I saw of Larissa after the baby was born. It was a difficult pregnancy in some ways. I, as granddad and father of the daughter, was worried sick, of course. But look at the peace in her eyes. When I think of Cheryl, when I think of you moms, when I think of you dads, and when I think of American education, I think of 1 Corinthians, where the Lord, it says, takes the things that are and makes them nothing. And he takes the things that are nothing and he makes them something. When I talk to homeschool moms, I hear so often, I'm nothing. Keep thinking that. Because that way you can love your child. Do you know about 1% of the American population is now getting a classical education? The American student population? I heard that recently. That was not happening 15 years ago. I have hope for America for one simple reason. Because moms love their children. And that love for their children is driving them to find out the best way to educate them. And it's rapid feedback that you have the freedom to switch quickly. And now the schools and colleges are learning from the homeschool moms who are learning so much so fast. And why are they learning so much so fast? Because they love their children. It's not a job. It's not a career. It's not a way to show off. It's not a way to find your place in society. It's because you love your children. Don't forget. Don't forget to keep doing that. Does this work as background music, or because I can't figure out how to turn it off now? This document was written by human beings. So is this. The Constitution of the United States is the only constitution more or less followed, more in the breach than in the observance now, more or less followed. But imagine what our political party, our political leadership would be like now if they didn't have this constitution. The musical scales were developed by a human being. And please don't forget this. There is, right now, a man seated at the right hand of God in heaven, interceding for you and me, having secured for us the gift of the Holy Spirit, having triumphed over death, having given us everything. That's a man. We are citizens with political duties. We are members of our local communities. And we need to get more involved. We complain all the time about the federal government, but one reason the federal government has so much power is because nobody joins the Homeowners Association unless they're going to go in there and cause trouble. Conservatism, which is I would call myself a pre-Rush Limbaugh conservative, an anti-ideological conservative. Conservatism is all about local government, getting involved at the local level so the federal level leaves you alone. If good people had been running the local governments in, say, Jim Crow South and ended that, we'd live in a different country now. We have vocations, and we need to remember the nature and details of those vocations. We're family members. We have husbands and wives and children and communities, and we're Christians. Our identity as Christians is formed with our union with Christ, who was born as a human being, who died as a human being, who rose from the dead as a man, and ascended into heaven bodily, with blood. And he is seated in authority as our Lord and Christ. And I fear that we have largely forgotten that there's a man seated in glory right now, representing us, who will come again. To remember these things, as Penelope remembered Odysseus, to remember with our souls and our bodies and our minds is to be a faithful bride to the Lord of heaven. We are remembering beings. We are driven by our memories. We are rooted in our memories. We're memory-based and memory-driven. Memory is so much a part of us that, like the blood in our veins, we rarely stop to be mindful of it. Our moral code is embodied in our memories. Our personal and community identities are bound up in what we remember. Our hopes arise from our memories of events and promises. Our relationships are defined by what and how we remember. The memory is a graveyard where ghosts linger and haunt our waking and our sleeping and our wakeful sleeping hours. It's a throne room where our hopes go to plead. It's an attic where symbols and signs of cherished things and people are stored, but cobwebs bear the way to the shrouded corners. It's an antechamber to the mind, a guard granting or forbidding entry, assigning places and determining what stays and what goes. And sometimes our memories are a nightmare, and sometimes they're a prophet. They are a self-building, self-guarding prison that nevertheless permits the daring to expand the walls anytime they want to. They're an army called up when the soul's enemies are spied out, stalking the outer courts or inner chambers. Sometimes our memories are a guide and sometimes they're a snare. Sometimes they're a loaf of bread and sometimes they're a stone. They're a chamber in which knowledge beyond knowing and memory beyond recollection is hidden in plain sight. Our memories are a treasury of every kind of wealth. There is no wealth without memory. They are a thank you card to the past. They're an alimentary canal. They're storytellers. They're servants. And they're masters. We say, remember me too. We say, remember me. We say, I will remember. But what does it mean to remember? Sometimes it means we recall something already in our mind. Sometimes to keep something in the mind. Sometimes to send greetings. Sometimes to recollect bits of information. We use words like remind, reminisce, record, memorize, amnesia, mnemonics. Don't forget, we say. But what does that strange word mean? The privative for, as in forego, does it mean to unget? Our memories, is it like being undead in the mind? Is it not begotten but forgotten? I don't really get it. What happens when we forget? Sometimes we have to forget. For example, if you're riding a glass elevator, don't use your imagination. We have to forget things that entice us and distract us. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the person who best remembers what ought to be remembered is the one who ought best to be remembered. That's why it matters enormously that we can cultivate our capacity to remember. We can cultivate our memory to help us better remember the different sorts of things that we need to remember. We do this all the time intuitively. It's good to notice it. We build memorials to remind us and to enable us to remind our children. This is from Gettysburg. This is Pennsylvania's view of their army and of what they achieved at Gettysburg. That there's you want to memorize stock market symbols, we do that. We build memorials to remind us and to enable us to remind our children. We have holy days. We even have secular holy days. Think of that. July 4th. When I was a boy, I remember being at the 4th of July in Milwaukee with my dad, and we were there to see the fireworks. And there's a war memorial on Lake Michigan in Milwaukee. And this was about 1971 or so. And there was this hippie with his harem sitting on a blanket nearby, pontificating about the evils of war. And he says, with all sorts of foul language, a lot of words I'd never heard before. And now, of course, they're in every movie. But this was 1971, 72, primitive age. And he starts carrying on about how can they build a war memorial, a memorial to war on the 4th of July. And my dad got sick of it. And I didn't see my dad get angry very often, but I saw him get really angry this time. He said, It's not a memorial to war, you idiot. It's a memorial to the people who died so that you could sit here on the 4th of July and talk like such a moron. I will never forget that. See, even the recording. See? Wish I could figure out how to turn that off. Our society wants to forget Christ. It's set aside Christmas. We're even embarrassed to mention Christmas. Some movies have been pouring out of the Hollywood memory manufacturing plant with an alternative Christmas, replacing the old memories with a set of purely nostalgic ones that have no there. For some reason, they think calling it a holiday is less religious than calling it Christmas, because I guess they forgot where the word holiday came from. We make buildings to help us remember things, although our devaluing of memory makes them much less than the mnemonic architecture of the Middle Ages, when you would walk into a building precisely so that you could remember stuff. Right? We talk about memory palaces in the Middle Ages. They had memory cathedrals. And I am convinced that the temple itself was designed by God to be a memory temple. And I believe that it works better than anything else because it is a model of the entire cosmos as well as heaven. I won't go into that now. We still memorize poems, though for us they're typically bad lyrics to bad music with varyingly disappointing tunes, but we still memorize Lady Gaga, whatever. If we need it for work or to show off, we'll even memorize tons of facts like stock market ticker symbols. We'll even, if we need it for work, body parts and diseases. Table of the elements. This is beautiful. Have you ever seen anything so beautiful as that? Okay, not the physical surface of it, but the truth it's teaching. However, we tend to value what our ancestors have achieved and handed on to us less than perhaps we ought. Perhaps we see Hamlet as a negative model. We see him, well, for a ghost. We throw out all the stuff the schools taught us, the saws, the forms, the pressures past, and we think of them as trivial, fond records. The one thing we do tend to remember is that one may smile and smile and be a villain. In other words, we live in a sadly, depressingly ironic age. We live in light, quite frankly, of World War I. We in America are less perhaps troubled by it because we joined both World War I and World War II a little bit late. So we could sing songs like over there, spread the word to beware over there. The French and Germans and English had already been there for 3 years and lost millions and millions of people. But we discovered a sort of national identity and we were changed. We were changed by that war. So is Europe. You want to understand the wasteland? Think about the trenches, the Archduke, April being cruel. A lot of things become much clearer about the wasteland when you think of it in light of the war that it was written immediately after. We are living in a culture suffering from a horrible case of amnesia. We are living in an age when it is actually kind of scary to remember. To remember the things we've done, to remember the kind of people that we are. But don't forget this. If we remember him who asked us to remember him, he will remember us the way he promised to remember the thief who said what to Jesus? Remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus did not say to the thief, this isn't about you. He said, this day you will be with me in paradise. If we remember him, he will remember us. And practically, you want practical? Spend all of your time remembering Jesus and all of your faculties, all of your natural abilities to remember. All of them will be improved for two reasons at least. I can think of a whole bunch now. One is because when you remember Jesus, the Holy Spirit is testifying, and he's bringing to life that energy and capacity to remember that he gave you in order to remember Jesus. And because the ability to remember is brought to life by the very Spirit of God, all of the things that the memory enables are rightly ordered and strengthened. And that is why in cultures and ages that have remembered Jesus most fervently, not just for the emotional benefit we get by thinking about him, but him personally, there has been always an enormous emphasis on memory skills, on developing memory skills. Old men forget. Yet all shall be forgotten. But he'll remember with advantages. What he did. On St. Crispin's Day. But every day is our Lord's Day. Let's remember him. And may the Lord remember you in his kingdom. Thank you.